The first case is 96-423, State of Ohio versus Kenneth Byros. Mr. Doughton.
Good morning, Your Honors. I am David Doughton, counsel for Kenneth Byros. Are you all right? I am here to apply the
Sure.
As aware of the court's record this morning, I would like to concentrate on the argument as to the first assignment there, which is the assignment that debates the entire trial. Tonight, committee would like to address the specification. However, again, the central comments in the front of the argument is the assignment of error one, and that is whether, in fact, Kenneth Byros was ever passively indicted in the first case. Upon reading the indictment, it is clear that it's deficient. The specification in this case merely reiterates almost word for word the principal charge. The problem with this indictment is threefold. First of all, it's violating jury protection under Ohio Constitution. Second of all, it violates the federal safety process for not giving proper notification by way of indictment processing. And third of all, it violates the Eighth Amendment of the United States Constitution on criminal legal punishment, as it, there's no narrowing function in this case. The fact that the grand jury prosecutor saw apparently knows what happened in the grand jury indictment, which merely reiterated the exact same elements in the principal charge of aggravated murder, made for no narrowing. There's no additional factors which is that which is constitutionally required to make Mr. Byros death eligible. I'd first like to address the grand jury issue, not only in this case, but I'm just sure to know that I've had a number of cases myself, where there is great confusion in the lower courts as to what Ohio's right to the grand jury is, the right to have each and every essential element be brought to the grand jury and found in place of the indictment. In this case, the grand jury never returned specification as required by the statute, indicating that Mr. Byros was the principal offender of the aggravated murder.
When was the first time you brought this to the attention of the court?
It was at the appellate court. It was not objected to at trial. It was not objected to. It was brought first to the 11th district.
So no issue that you're now arguing was ever brought to the attention of the trial court?
That
or
is,
anybody at that level.
That is correct.
Okay.
However, Your Honor, this is a jurisdictional issue for Ohio. This court has held on a number of occasions that if there is an illegal sentence, and the court doesn't have jurisdiction to address or to sentence a particular defendant, no matter what the particular charge is, then the trial court always has jurisdiction, and any court has jurisdiction to correct the sentence, which is flat out illegal. In this case, there's no waiver involved because it's an illegal sentence in the first place. The trial court lacked the jurisdiction to sentence Mr. Byros to death because he was not indicted for the death penalty.
What critical information was missing from
that Mr. Byros was the principal offender in the commission of the aggravated murder?
Was anybody else charged?
No. And I would like to address that issue. The problem I have with this argument.
Who does that leave as the principal offender?
Well, again, this is the first, the grand jury. What if Mr. Byros said someone else was involved? Then all of a sudden, the element that he was the principal offender.
Did he say that? Did he?
No, he did not. But this, as the court is well aware, this decision will set down on Mr. Byros' case and any other cases. This is not the case, but there was someone else involved, and I did the same thing because he threatened my family. Now, all of a sudden, this principal offender element, which was not an element because he didn't mention it, suddenly becomes an element because he's alleged for someone else.
Can't there be waiver at any point?
Not under jurisdiction.
What else is missing?
In the indictment, that language, that principal language, he was principal offender in the commission of an aggravated murder.
But when there's one defendant involved, one person indicted, it's, while it would the ideal situation, of course, to have that language in, but it would be redundant. There's no one else that could be the principal offender.
Well, I disagree from the standpoint, again, the prior cases, Joseph, those cases were not decided and were not addressed to the grand jury. And the problem that I have with that is if a citizen of this state has the right to have a grand jury return on each and every essential element, I mean, so what we're saying is the fact that he was a principal offender in aggravated murder is not an element or is not a material element in this case or the specification. Of course it is. And if the state, and I guess the example I would like to use is that if a person broke into a warehouse, he's charged with breaking and entering by the grand jury. The facts come out that, in fact, he broke into a separately secured portion of that warehouse. In fact, it was a security guard. So clearly, it's an aggravated burglary. The prosecutor tells the defense lawyer that it's an aggravated burglary. The jury is instructed it's an aggravated burglary. The prosecutor argues aggravated burglary the entire time. No objections are ever made. In fact, the jury returns the verdict as aggravated burglary. If this case were brought to this court, my belief is because they did not return to the grand jury to have the grand jury return on the additional elements that were found in the case would be stripped down. And I do not see the difference between that scenario and this scenario. In the scenario I used, the example, everyone knew it was an aggravated burglary. He had noticed it was an aggravated burglary. The case was tried and defended as an aggravated burglary. However, the case was reversed for the grounds that the prosecutor did not properly go to the grand jury. Basically, what's happening is the court, you know, indicating no one else was there, they're making the jury finding that he's the principal offender.
Didn't State versus Joseph recently, doesn't that clarify this case?
Well, no. There were two different reasons. One is Joseph didn't address the grand jury issue.
It didn't address the indictment.
It did not on a grand jury basis and a due process basis, and there are other differences in Joseph.
Joseph indictment was less informative than the one we have here.
I would disagree. In Joseph, they added the additional language. However, in Joseph, they indicated the principal offender of the underlying felony. But Joseph, the jury...
What is the purpose of an indictment?
The purpose of an indictment is to give notice. And is to make sure that an independent body...
Give notice to who?
The defendant.
Of what?
Of the offense charge.
Didn't the indictment in this case give notice to the defendant of the
crime charged? The language was sufficient. Again, the grand jury, any citizen of the state has the right to have a grand jury return or to address every essential element of the offense. It did not happen in this case. In any case, I guess there's a third argument. In any case, if the prosecutor, as long as the prosecutor gave the defendant notice and no particulars or just in conversation.
Well, I'm more concerned about the lack of notice to the trial court that this was a problem at that level, so it could have been taken care of there. You want us to completely ignore that the trial attorney for the defendant absolutely missed it or forgot about it or did it on purpose, didn't bring it to the attention of the trial court strictly for creating some type of error on appeal.
Well,
shouldn't the trial judge be given the problems involved in the case at the trial court level so he could do something about it? Why come back and ambush and say, well, you know, it wasn't in the indictment, and the defense attorney didn't even think about this at that time. He thought it was all right because he didn't object, right?
Was there a bill of particulars prepared in this?
No particulars in the record.
No requests?
No bill of particulars in the record. The prosecutor addressed it in brief. There's nothing in the record the prosecutor received.
I don't see why we should so lightly dismiss the fact that the trial attorney didn't bring this to the attention of the trial court. Said, well, that's jurisdictional. That he didn't have to do that.
Fine, do it. Okay, I did read three. One, the state was certainly aware that there was a decision that should have been. The judge was aware, No question about it. However, if the, and it was raised in effective assistance, there is an issue on the
Sure, it was.
And in this case, I guess it was the court to decide how important is the grand jury. I mean, does your right to a grand jury mean anything? If the prosecutor fails to use the grand jury properly and deprives the citizen right to have a grand jury decide the case, if the lawyer doesn't bring that to the attention, then that citizen's right is waived, then it's no longer necessary to have the grand jury be out of the way. In this case, Ohio's right to the grand jury means something. This court has held even does on a sentencing specification. So no one has argued, that the specification was legitimate. And no one argued that the particular defendant that committed this prior offense could not be added to an amended to an indictment because it was essential element to the court. In this case, it was even sentencing against them. They had to go back to the grand jury. And the defense didn't object to it. In that case, in Dilley, the state versus Dilley, there was no objection to the state. It was raised, it was reversed, and the specification was thrown out merely because the prosecutor didn't properly exercise the rights under the grand jury. That is this case. The state was there. I mean, the statute is right there. The statute says clearly what it must be. In this case, another difference between Joseph is, in Joseph, the jury had the actual verdict form, properly had the elements of the offense. The verdict form the jury signed in Joseph had the elements properly laid out.
This did not.
This did not. There was nothing. At no point the court did instruct as to the proper elements. The jury verdicts did not have the proper elements. And so at no time did the jury cite any additional element other than that it was a felony murder. There was one count, there was a felony murder spec, two of them, one which apparently was and that was it. And the only specification was the principal charge was administering commission of felony, the indictment was administering commission of felony.
Well, but it also referred to the statute, right? The indictment referred to the statute, the appropriate section of the statute, which includes the part that wasn't stated explicitly. I mean, if we're talking about notice, if the purpose is notice, the defendant through his lawyer did have notice of which section of the statute he was being indicted under. Isn't that, you would agree with that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Usually when we determine things are matters are jurisdictional, it's because they are of such importance to the justice of the case that without compliance with whatever it is of the rule or the statute, we say there's no jurisdiction for the court to do something. If the purpose here of the indictment and the statute is to give notice, why isn't that the test? Is whether the plaintiff or whether the defendant here had notice of what it was he was being charged with. And there, pick up on Justice Sweeney's questions, why isn't waiver the important question then?
Again, it's mixing and matching two different issues. One is basically if the court is going to decide that if the defendant has been given notice in whatever means, it doesn't matter what happened in the grand jury. I have a real problem with that. Because basically, the right to a grand jury ceases to exist for all practical purposes. And secondly, in this case, a reference to the statute, no one knows what happened in the grand jury. No one knows if the language was
ethics, I think that's a, I think that's taking the suggestion beyond beyond its bounds. Here, if there were two, if there were two defendants or two persons, the grand jury was given evidence that there were two people that that could have done what was done here to this victim, then you'd have a different argument. I mean,
then you have a some kind of, I mean, you know, the statutory language requires an indictment, and if it's not included, what you're saying is, in some cases, an element, sometimes it's not.
Now, it's always an element. The question is whether the defendant is on notice that it is an element in his case. And
the State versus Sellers, this court is required to be in the grand jury. It is not notice, it is not proper notice, it is a violation of due process unless it's properly contained in the indictment. That's this court's decision. And again, the problem is this court is looking at the record and indicating in the record that, well, he was the principal offender, so therefore it doesn't matter if the jury came back on that element or not. And regardless of the facts of the case, what we're allowing is the appellate courts to substitute the finding for a principal element in the case. And it does not matter how apparent it is from the record. It's still an invasion of the province of the jury to return a verdict on each and every essential element. In this case, the jury at no point in time was permitted to return on each and every essential element. They were instructed, the indictment didn't contain.
Your concern here is that the grand jury, members of the grand jury, never considered whether the defendant was the principal offender. Is that
correct?
Even though we would assume that they were told that the defendant was the only person there, do we? Or can we not? We don't assume that. Yeah. Okay. Could happen. Right.
And then all of a sudden, is the court going to decide, well, we said it wasn't an element originally, but now it is an element. I mean, either in statutory construction, it's an element or it is an element. In this case, the code is very, very clear that it's required if it is an essential element of the case. Otherwise, well, yeah, the court specifically noted that the language of the specification, of the felony murder specification, is different. And is different than what the felony murder charge is, that it was done so still no evidence of any rape or attempted rape having transpired. In my opinion, the horrendous condition is being seen most commonly. However, anything that may have happened is pure speculation, and actually the evidence indicates that what happens is even happened after her death, so that any evidence as to the manipulations and manipulations, if you will, occurred after death. I mean, even in the state's theory, is the victim was pounded on the railroad tracks, and they have blood splatter experts to come in and indicate that there was some sort of fight and that the death occurred after. Milo's indicated that there was he accidentally struck with the car, that there was a screaming match, and that there was an asphyxiation occurred. And that any evidence available, even if most favorable to the state, indicated clearly that anything that may have happened after death, but there is no evidence. And again, the key point that I would like to bring out is in the 11th district's affirming of this specification. Or underlying felony was that, or neglected to mention that, Mr. Byros indicated to the officer, not to testify, that he denied ever making any kind of sexual advance to her. I see that my time is about out. You rest on the brief as to the demand assignments of error, and I respectfully request that this court dismiss the cabinet specification and turn this case, remain this case for recess. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dowden. Mr. McCarthy.
Hey, police supporter, my name is Pat McCarthy. I'm assistant prosecutor for Trumbull County. Going to the first issue that I think. First of all, there's a lot of talk in the brief and also in your large defense counsel about the fact that this is some type of constitutionally required language, principal offender language.
Wouldn't a clean, neat rule for us to announce be that the indictment is insufficient if it doesn't state all of the elements of the charge with which the defendant is being charged against the defendant? Wouldn't that be just, then we wouldn't have all this case-by-case cases that we, considerations we have. Just say, has to, you have to state it or you don't, you can't try it. What's wrong with that rule?
Well, it's clean and neat. I won't disagree with that. But it intends and ignores the reality that it is a case-by-case determination.
Why should we be put in this position to have failed out at this point?
The state doesn't see this being failed out. The state sees it as whether this defendant's rights were left. That's the question before the court.
As the chief just indicated, we'd be on to other arguments. Presumably less persuasive if there'd just been a little care taken to indicate the key elements of the statute. This is, after all, a death case.
Correct.
It couldn't have been anything more important going on in the office that day than
yes, sir.
Doing this right.
Again, I think I would go back to the thought that what right has this violation here? We have right to know what the charge is. He had not noticed what the charge was. There was a statement made by defense counsel at one point that the only thing indicating it was a specification was the fact that it said it was a specification. It said it was a specification. He had noticed it was a specification. As Chief Justice Moyer pointed out, the statutory number was in there, 2929 or 487, designated specifically by its statutory number. In the Joseph case, which this court recently decided, the facts of Joseph are far more compelling against the state than they were in this case. In Joseph, you have two different defendants in a joint indictment, and the indictment specification language indicated that the defendant had committed the aggravated murder and was a principal offender committing the aggravated murder and committing the kidnapping. Didn't say it was a principal offender committing the murder. I mean, it was totally wrong. And it was indicating that there was, and then the state brought up in the case and said, we don't have to prove which one was the actual killer. That's observed in the partial dissent of Chief Justice Moore, that the state took the position from
that's at the indictment stage. What if, as Mr. Dowden suggests, it is not impossible that at the indictment stage there appears to be one principal offender, one person involved in the crime, and at the trial or sometime after the indictment stage, another person appears. Lo and behold, there are two people there, three people there. I mean, that's not beyond the realm of possibility, certainly, is it?
Well, it's not beyond the realm of possibility. The question, again, the state's what's his time and place on this is what the state is alleging in this case. There was a comment by the defense counsel that there was another bill of particulars. And that's correct. The bill of particulars itself is not filed as a document. But it's noted in my brief, it is quoted. State's bill of particulars is quoted in the motion by the defendant. In that bill of particulars, quotations directly out of the defendant's motion, there is language within there indicating that this defendant and no other identified as nobody else that was doing these acts, was committing this murder, and that was at the same time committing the attempt to committing the act of fraud. The statute on the specification as to what must include. I believe I was saying earlier that there's an allegation for a certain constitution required language. 2941.14c says that the language of specification may be used in the words of the statute or may be set forth in words sufficient to give the accused notice of the statute. In this case, and I turn to what Lucas County experience was on this issue in the Esparza case. In the Esparza case, you had the identical issue happen. The specification was an ASAP specification, and the language principal offender was not included. And Esparza, the court found that where there was no other defendant mentioned, where there was no co-defendant, then there would be a redundancy to require, as part of the indictment, the principal offender language. And again, all goes back to where's the prejudice? Where is the violation of the defendant's rights in this circumstance where he and no other person is indicted, where the indictment itself, the defense in this case, seems to want to take a piecemeal approach to looking at this indictment. Let's look at this language that sets forth the specification and focus in fully on the idea that it doesn't include these two words, principal offender, but it ignores the fact that the indictment itself has the language specification of aggravating circumstance. It has statutory designation. The thought that this specification wasn't really a specification, it was an aggravated murder charge, is refuted by the face of the indictment, which says it's a specification. There's no question. And
what did the jury, the verdict form say?
The verdict form tracked the language of the indictment. It did not include the principal offender language. However, first of all, the statement notes that there was absolutely no objection to making the verdict form for the jury instructions. In that regard, the state would point out that it was noticed in the Joseph case that the defendant, that there's a situation here, it showed the lack of prejudice, that nobody questioned the validity of this indictment up to this point in time. There was some questioning of defense counsel as to the waiver. This defendant sat and went through trial, and it is so evident that he was never questioned. There was never any question that he knew exactly what he was being charged with. He was being charged with his principal.
Counsel, I understand all that. This would be, your whole argument would be more appealing to me if you prefaced it by saying, we made a mistake. We made a pretty big mistake, but it's harmless.
Well, I certainly have to concur with that sentence. The state made a mistake. It would have been ideal if Justice Bradley said to have that principle of language within that indictment. However, this is a case-by-case determination that needs to be made by this court. The court has to consider the facts and circumstances of each case. It would be a clean and easy rule to just cut it off and say, it's not in there, game over.
Okay, let me move you to the rape.
Yes, on that issue, Your Honor, it ignores reality. It ignores the vast amount of evidence that was submitted at the trial to say that all there was to show the intent to groom was this statement by Byron that he touched her knee or touched her hand. this woman was found with her sexual organs excised, taken out, and those organs were never discovered. Her vagina, her anus, and one of her breasts were cut out, and vagina and the anus were never recovered. In this case, the state was in a situation where it did not have the ability to collect evidence on a rape, because that evidence by the defendant had been taken out and destroyed, or something was done with it that effectively couldn't be utilized. Now, to say when a person, that a rational jury, cannot draw an inference from that, that there was attempted sexual conduct in this case, the state submits, absolutely ignores reality. This is not a case such as Kindish or the more recent Davis case, where all there was a body found in some state of not being clothed and some generic statements being made.
What was your expert testimony? You had some expert testimony in this area. Okay, what was the nature of that to help? Did you have some expert testimony to help the jury with the presumption?
Well, Dr. Fox, the coroner in the case, testified, first of all, as to the nature of all of those. And as there was testimony that the excising of the organs was post-mortem. However, there were 96 pre-mortem wounds. Included within those 96 pre-mortem wounds were stab wounds in the breast area, bruising.
Yeah, I understand all that. Did you have any testimony from any so-called expert that said when you see activity of this nature,
Dr. Fox testified that this was evidence of sexual mutilation, and it's almost a self-evident thing. When the sexual organs are taken out and mutilated, his testimony was this is evidence of sexual mutilation.
Didn't connect that up to rape and rape or attempted rape.
I think the evidence was more of a nature that he indicates actually that this is evidence of sexual mutilation. It was an argument of the state that evidence of sexual mutilation certainly allows an inference that sexual conduct took place.
But there was no expert presented by the state.
There was nothing presented in the nature of like a profiling or something.
That's what I meant.
No, there wasn't. But again, it is virtually patently offensive to the state to just ignore the condition of the body, ignore what was done.
Because there were no other parts taken away or except sexual organs.
No, that's incorrect. Her she decapitated.
I understand that, yes, that part, but I mean, what other parts were taken out?
Well, I'm not sure where you're going, but she was eviscerated, her intestines were taken out, she was decapitated, her leg was cut off, one of the breasts was excised, and it was more important for us to describe to her. But the bottom line, on the attempt to break the specification, is simply the state's estimation that certainly, the fact that Mr. Byers denied sexual conduct, if that were the standard, he admitted, he denied the original statement that he later contradicted himself at trial. His original statement to the police, he said that she died when she fell out of the car onto railroad tracks that they were in. And in his trial testimony, he said, no, she fell out of the car. I hit her with the car, she somehow tumbled over the top, bounced on her head so many times to make all these contusions, and then that's how she died. And I went up and I may have throttled her somehow. But I mean, he contradicted the fact that he told an officer at some point, denied sexual activity, doesn't contend the issue by any means, especially for the overwhelming evidence in this case, where what he did say to the officer was, he admitted to touching her knee, and at one point said he went further. He took her to a desolate area. This was an intoxicated young woman. To a desolate railroad area. In the early morning hours, and did what the evidence shows he did. The idea
You do have to show sexual conduct, right?
Correct.
Not sexual activity. You agree? There are two
correct.
Discrete
yes.
definitions. Which technically we don't have here. Is that? Would you agree?
Well, technically, it's a matter of in a rape case where you have rape kit done and you're finding the sperm, there's a strong inference there. But absent somebody coming in virtually any type of case involving sexual conduct and saying that this occurred, circumstantial evidence can be every bit as probative and meaningful as direct evidence. And in this case, certainly the state, unfortunately, and as in all murder cases, did not have the ability to have the victim in this case come in and say what had happened. But what the evidence that her body left speaks volumes.
Well, one would think that the conduct that was engaged in here would be sexual conduct in the statute, but it isn't. Maybe the General Assembly will, after this case, will do something about that.
Well, exactly, Your Honor, but even in that event, I would note that it is a statutory specification, not actually a requirement. Did he take a substantial step in this case for committing sexual conduct with this woman? The state feels the evidence on this issue is absolutely it just ignores a huge portion of the evidence saying that all there is this vague conversation that he gave about touching.
Refresh my recollection. Is it required under the statute of the case law that the conduct or the attempted conduct occur before death?
Your Honor, I would think that there is a charge of abuse of force that certainly could have some ability where it occurs after death, but if it's sexual conduct against a person, I believe it would probably. But I guess what I would mean is that.
Okay, well, what I'm getting at is that conduct could occur before or after
yes,
death.
Right.
Is it sufficient to get a death specification
if
the conduct occurs after death contemporaneous with, I mean, part of the same transaction?
Okay. Well, yes.
But after.
I mean, the language of the specification, which is the point I want to get into, was not been mentioned so far, is the state's right prosecutor.
Right. And I want to get you to that in just a minute, but in terms of the jury had to find the specification based on inferences.
Right.
Because your direct evidence
sure.
wasn't there, it wasn't there.
Well, our direct evidence was there, though, Your Honor, because the point
of mutilation. But
well, the mutilation, but there was also evidence of pre-mortem wounds to the bruising, to the groin area, to the breast area, to what was available to be analyzed. There were pre-mortem wounds in those areas. So it wasn't solely a case. The excising of the organs did take place after death, according to the pathologist's testimony. However, that is not in any way states in this that the pre-mortem wounds that were evident and the defendant's indications that he was making advances were indicative of an attempt to commit sexual conduct.
I guess I'm one who thinks sometimes we get overly strung out on technicalities, but what I'm trying to elicit from you is what of this horrible evidence, what was the jury permitted to consider in arriving at its conclusion that you had a death specification off of attempted rape? Does the activity post-mortem, can that go into the mix in terms of determining the spec or not?
Yes, Your Honor, and I believe the reason it can is because of the language of the specification itself. The language of the specification says that he committed an aggravated murder while he was committing or attempting to commit rape. Wow. The interpretation this court has given to the word wow in that specification is that it
case that you can point to that includes activity post-death?
And specifically in the rape case?
Yeah.
Not that I can call to mind this point, Your Honor, but in a similar circumstance, and this is going to lead me into the cross-appeal issue.
I want to get you there because that's important.
Yeah, on the cross-appeal issue, and this has not been opposed in any fashion at this point by the defense, we had a circumstance where the Court of Appeals reversed the aggravated robbery specification based on its finding that there was no evidence showing that the intent, that Mr. Byers' intent to commit the aggravated robbery had been formed prior in time to when he committed the murder. That exact issue was brought before this court on a case that I argued from a county, Andre Williams, that was pending before this court at the time that the appellate court decision in the Byers case came down. The state cross-appealed in the Andre Williams case on the idea that there's a the state's position was there is no requirement that the state provide evidence showing that the intent to commit the underlying felony for the ASAP specification must have been developed prior to time to commission of the murder. This court adopted the state's argument. It is still this law. There is no such requirement.
Counsel, which specification do you think is the strongest? Which is your strongest case?
Purely evidentiary.
Forget about the Court of Appeals.
Purely evidentiary basis.
On a purely evidentiary basis.
On a purely evidentiary basis. The evidence. It's truly hard for me to answer, Your Honor, because there's different ways that the evidence fits together in this case. I mean, the state, as I was saying when I was talking about the attempt to break the specification, the evidence, particularly the excise of the organs and the pre-mortem moves to those areas, the state's it's incredibly powerful. It's indicating that there was an attempt to engage in sexual conduct here. By the same token, the aggravated robbery, this defendant himself admitted having, when he was carrying the body around after having killed Tammy Angstrom, that he took wedding ring off. His mother talked to him the next day and said, you know, where's this ring? Where'd you get this ring from? He tells his own mother, who testified at trial, that the ring came from the girl last night. And we recovered that ring, and we had witnesses testifying that she had been wearing that ring earlier in the day. He had the ring. He stole the ring. And under the law, with the Rojas case, the Smith case, the argument that's been made in one of the propositions of law is that the ring was simply taken as an afterthought sometime after the murder occurred. And this court had definitively and expressly overruled that notion. A defendant cannot avoid the effect of the felony murder rule by quoting on surveillance case, killing somebody at a leisurely and methodical pace, and then going back later and taking the property. And the asportation of the property has to occur while the offense of aggravated robbery, under the express language of the specification, has to occur while he was committing or attempting to commit or was committing the murder. That being the definition of wow in that as interpreted by this court, being that it was associated with the murder as one continuous sequence. He killed her. He dragged her. He took the ring off. He kept the ring. He committed the theft offense, which was undoubtedly associated. So when he asked me, I know it sounds like a typical oral argument response, saying, you know, which one's your strong one, or the most strong? Well, they are both strong. They're incredibly strong in the state's estimation. The evidence, this entire case, is enormously strong. And that's the crux that this court has looked at. I'm going to dovetail back a little bit into the original issue on the indictment. That's the crux here. That this court has looked at in other cases involving the question Sneed case, in which this court had an argument before it that by including the alternatives from the specification language, that he was either the principal offender or if not, that he committed a prior calculation of cyanide. Including both those alternatives in, the possibility was left open that some jurors found him to be a principal offender, some found him to have committed a prior calculation of cyanide. She didn't have a unanimous jury verdict here. What the Sneed court said was in cases where the evidence allows no other conclusion but that he was the principal offender, we are not, there can be no error in allowing the jury to consider these alternatives, particularly where the alternatives are taken from the direct language of the statute. In this case, the principal offender issue, there's just no question. It would be competing, I believe, some sort. It would be the absolute, ultimate exaltation of form over substance. It's to say that he didn't be charged with the defense as the principal offender, that he wasn't proved to be the principal offender in this case. The evidence screams it.
So
he admitted.
Let me take you back to this. Cross appeal and the, maybe I'm getting the wrong sense of this case, but help me out. Isn't what you actually had to go to trial with was two strong cases on two separate specifications that are logically inconsistent with each other, and a defendant who doesn't tell you why he did it, but if he did it for the robbery, perhaps the mutilation is an aberration.
Logically speaking,
yeah, and if he did it. As a part of an attempted rape or rape, that then the robbery is incidental to and an afterthought.
Well, aren't you
sort of stuck with this dilemma?
Well, the state doesn't consider it a dilemma because, first of all, there's a single motivation for the crime. It's either sexual, which in this case, the term sexual, violent sexual. Or that it was to have taken this property. There could be multiple motivations. The state in this situation is not going to try, cannot, would not deign to try to explain the motivation of this crime. It's inexplicable. It's so horrendous. But in this circumstance, from a pure and a psychologist, the studies you have to go is what's his motivation? Is this a sexual? Is this to steal? The state on the aggravated robbery, it occurred. He sold it. Now, whether he was thinking, this court rejected the notion that he had to go in Williams' case thinking. I'm gonna take property. In Williams' case, actually, it was an attempted rape specification. And what had occurred was Andre Williams had gone into this home, and they were presumably going in there to commit an aggravated robbery. And once he was in there, they killed an elderly gentleman, and his wife was there, and he attempted to rape his wife. And the specification of the 11th District struck down that case with the attempted rape based on their finding that the state did not submit evidence that proved that that he informed the intent to attempt to commit rape prior to killing Mr. Mellon, the elderly gentleman in this case. This court flat out rejected the idea that he had to go in that house and sometime before meeting Mr. Mellon, that we have to have some kind of evidence showing when this intent came into mind. There is no requirement in the specifications, express language, that we have to prove intent. That's the crux of the cross appeal. has addressed, Rob Thompson has addressed in State versus Smith, and said, you don't get off the hook when you kill a person and take their property after they're dead. It just doesn't work that way. You can commit an aggravated robbery if you kill someone that didn't take their property. This court made that point entirely clear, and it's made the point even more clear that that aggravated robbery, as long as it occurs while the aggravated murder is occurring, while again being associated with it as one part of one continuous occurrence, it is a legitimate specification. And in this case, there can be no division, some imaginary division saying that murder done, no longer a continuous occurrence when he takes this brain off. This is all a continuous occurrence. These are all connected events. They can't be split off in that fashion. In short, State was said that, again, the indictment in this case certainly wouldn't have been able to have first principle amendment in there, but the facts in this case are certain, and analyzed on a case by case basis, there can be no question that he has happened to us. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McCarthy. Mr. Doughton, you saved about 7.5 minutes of your time.
Mr. Doughton, help me with the proposition that but for the missing language in the indictment, the trial would have been different. The outcome of the trial would have been different.
So, Your Honor, what we have here is structural error. And there was a structural error which the Supreme Court, United States Supreme Court itself, was not really subjected to a harmless error analysis. This all goes back to the constitutional right for one narrowing, which did not occur in this case, and to have the grand jury decide each and every essential element. As a practical matter, would the outcome have been different had he been indicted properly? I'm not going to sit here and argue that the evidence would have been different had he been properly indicted, but this gets down to the very...
So you're not arguing plain error?
In this case, we're arguing jurisdiction, but it's just that he could not have been waived because of jurisdiction. He did raise, as I mentioned before,
your argument is jurisdictional and not plain error.
Correct.
So you don't have to show that the outcome would have been different.
You do not have to show that that's an error.
Yes, sir.
Your Honor, there is one other point. I feel that I'm comfortable talking about the cross appeal because there was a motion for leave to cross appeal. We did not respond because the court never made a ruling on that motion.
It's been argued. I think you better respond.
Well, I understand that. Just one point I feel uncomfortable with that because...
And what you're saying is you're also, if you can claim that it's not here, if you don't want to waive that by making an argument.
Exactly.
All right.
Exactly. However,
I think we understand
what you're saying. One thing that is clear is that when you look at the 11th District's decision in this case, they weren't basing it totally on Williams. They went through the facts of this case. They didn't be so short. Went through the facts of this case and indicated and argued in test. What the court very clearly pointed out was that the testimony that came in, the ring was just put in the pocket to take it off of her hand as the track was bothering him as he was dragging. And there's a real issue whether there was really an intent when the ring was the actual physical taking was there. But there's no question whether there was really any intent to see what height is, whatever. And as a matter of fact, the Court of Appeals mentioned that, the fact that it was...
So it got in his pocket because it got in his pocket because it was interfering with his ability to drag her body.
Yes.
That's what the jury was given a chance to consider. I mean, was that the argument?
Yes.
So. And the jury decided that question?
Yes. But that comes down to whether it was reasonable for the jury and whether the district found it was not reasonable under these facts and that determination. Again, and the problem, and again, this brings right around the question that just Sweeney brought up. The problem with doing this on case by case, this is what gets down to, instead of having a general rule that the grand jury needs
okay, well, you talk about narrowing.
Yes.
Did the indictment not charge him with a a specification relating to rape or attempted rape.
But that would make it an aggravated murder in the first place.
All right, but he's on notice that attempted rape is a spec.
Attempted rape is what made it from a murder to an aggravated murder. They use the same spec to make it from murder to ag murder, and then use the same spec again to make it from ag murder to an aggravated case. And that's the whole reason that the specification requires additional language. Again, it should be pointed out, the verdict forms in this case did not have any reference to 2929, 0487. There was no reference to it. The jury itself never decided and never even addressed that essential element.
The indictment and jury verdict did, however, contain the specification attempted rape and the specification robbery.
Which our position is it's still robbery, yes. But our position is that it's mere surface use, that it's merely repeated the language of the indictment. Again, what's important in this case, remember, is without that language, it's aggravated murder. This is a murder case. And it elevates the aggravated murder. This isn't charged in prior calculation design. This is a felony murder. And elevated from murder to aggravated murder, they brought the fact that it was a rape. And then they bootstrapped it one more time. So that, in fact, there was no additional element to limit the class of death eligible people in this case. Again, that issue has not been addressed any other than that. If the court will, my final point, the question about rape after death, you know, I would argue there, I would find no case as to that. Again, this court has held, and many others, the argument specific versus general, that where there is a specific statute that directly addresses the facts of the case, that the specific statute wins out over general. In this case, there is an absolute specific statute that fits abuse of a corpse, and that therefore it would preclude the conclusion of rape as a specification after the fact. I think State versus Teeter, T-A-T-E-R, is the leading case in that, but very clearly, this court is held that we're absolutely okay.
I guess I'm not asking about the rape or the attempted rape occurring after death. What I was raising is the evidence of mutilation and sexual mutilation. Some of that obviously occurs after death.
I think all of it occurred after death.
There were some wounds.
There were wounds, but I think that the wounds of stabbing is more in what the appellant said, that there was a heated, angry argument, and it was after the fact.
Do you disagree, though, that the evidence of what occurred after death could be considered for the jury to arrive at its inference and conclusion?
I disagree completely with that, because Justice Resnick's question was very good in that this wasn't solely the sex organs that were taken, you know,
But why can't events that occur after the death be included in arriving at a conclusion based on some inferences?
That there
was an attempted rape.
Theoretically, in some cases it can. In this case, there is the evidence of what happened afterwards does not relate to rape whatsoever. I mean, I think that it's very important, as Justice Resnick asked, I'm not sure what the intent, but the question was that this was many non-sexual organs were also accepted in this case. That the defendant's purported reason was to hide the evidence so that it would not be found. And he felt it easier to do that if, you know, it was placed in many different areas. This is not a case that was solely the sexual organs. This is not a case that every bit of evidence, even the state's theory leading up to it, and how the killing occurred, it was either hit with a car by the defense or knocking the head on the railroad tracks, but there is nothing else to indicate that. I think the mere number of wounds, according to Dr. Cox,
Well, but doesn't that lead to an inference that the attempted rape was not successful because she fought him off and he was so angry that he mutilated her, albeit he didn't stop at the sexual organs, but the fact that he was pretty creative in the carving out sexual organs, that a jury could infer from that, I would think, that... Well... Yeah, but that's...
A passion-type mutilation. And furtherwith, it's a huge speculation. I mean, the fight, for all we know, could have been that she was with another man, that she didn't want to date him anymore. And he got enraged because she wasn't dating him, wouldn't go out with him, or wouldn't go home with him, for that matter. But that's not rape. That's not attempted rape, because he's angry, she won't do what he wants her to do. I mean, it's just speculation, and it's real hard to, again, we're substituting
Your time. Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.